Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. My guest today needs no introduction, but we're going to give him one because he was in Motley Crue and he deserves it, damn it. In addition to being a bona fide rock legend, he's also a writer and an activist. He showcased both talents with his 2007 memoir, The Heroin Diaries, A Year in the Life of a Shattered Rock Star. The brutally honest self-portrait topped the New York Times bestsellers list and helped change the conversation around addiction and recovery. Now he's back with a new book about his early years entitled The First 21, How I Became Nikki Sixx. It chronicles his tumultuous youth being shuttled among family members in the Midwest before heading to Los Angeles at age 17 to seek his fortune. Sure, there are hedonistic tales of L.A. at its most debauched in the late 70s, but The First 21 is also a story about hope, hard work, and endurance. I'm so happy to welcome Nikki Sixx. First off, every superhero needs their origin story, and that's what The First 21 is. Your new memoir focuses on your early years. What kickstarted this project? What made you decide to share this part of your story now?
Well, one thing that really concerns me and has for years is that athletes, musicians, entrepreneurs that come into money, a lot of times they end up broke. Yeah. So, you know, I have this way that I do it, and I've done it since day one. I save 20% of everything I ever make. That's after taxes, after commissions, and I have to adjust my life around that. So I wanted to kind of write a book and like help other people, like, you know, myself, to have these ideas and dreams, spend their whole life, and then they get a deal with the NBA, and then 5 years later they're broke. Yeah. And I was really excited about the idea, and we have a lot of property where we live here in Wyoming, and the back part of my property is like 20 acres. I go back on the back part, and I'm sitting on this kind of the end of the property goes down into a gulch, and I was sitting there, and as the crow flies, I'm literally 2 hours from where I grew up in Idaho, right across the Grand Tetons. So I'm looking out and I'm thinking to myself, you know, just how beautiful and different this is than Hollywood. And it reminds me of my childhood. And then I had this fleeting thought, and it was like, well, where did everybody go? And I came in the house and I wrote this like couplet, like a short poem. And it said, one of the lines was, you know, once I started to fly, I forgot how to stop. And it wasn't you that lost out. It was me in a lot of ways, losing connection to childhood friends and to family. And that's like, you know, the financial book is something I'd like to do sometime in the future. But it doesn't sound very sexy. You know, it doesn't sound very, does really anybody want that book now during the pandemic? There's enough stress, and, you know, I'm 62, you know, maybe in, you know, 8-10 years, that's something that might be more interesting. And, I called up our team and I said, I want to tell my story from birth to 21, but the day I changed my name to Nikki Sixx. We started talking about it. And we got really excited. It's a prequel, so to speak. It also was an opportunity to not only tell a story of a small town boy that fell in love with, you know, music, first on AM radio, and then FM, and then vinyl. And I was in a small town, 4,000 people, and took that passion and went for it. And it's the obstacles along the way. It's the lessons you learn. It's everything that was able to put together in the first 21 years. I believe that whether you're talking to LeBron James, or if you're talking to a top race car driver, or if you're talking to Keith Richards, probably somewhere in their first 21 years, they're going to have that kind of like aha moment. Like, this is what I want to do. People in radio tell me, yeah, remember this moment going to be in radio. People that are podcasters were like telling me that they were influenced by these people. And then when podcasting came along, gave an opportunity. And a lot of this happens in our youth, because in our youth, we throw caution to the wind. And if you're Tony Hawk now, you probably don't want to jump off the top of a a house on a skateboard. But when he was in his first 21 years, I'm sure that's what made him one of the greatest. He was, you know, felt invincible. And so I wanted to capture some of that innocence and the discovery of music.
Yeah, what was that aha moment for you? What did success look like for you as a kid growing up in Idaho?
I never really knew there was such a thing as success or money or any of it. I just wanted to be in a band. I wanted to find people that wanted to do the same thing I wanted to do, which was to play music. And my idea of what I wanted for music is not the same as that guy or that guy. And going to Los Angeles and slugging it out and going through auditions and trying to put together musicians that were like-minded. And I was very, very strategic and very organized in my head. It's like, I am not going to be in a band with a guy that like that and a guy like that. Like, I got to have a band with four stars in the band, five stars. Like, that's what I want. That's what I grew up with. And so it was the focus of what I wanted while I was learning to be a songwriter and copying the greats, whether it was the Cheap Tricks or the Aerosmiths, Sweets or the Slades and the Pistols, and putting it all into my own blender and coming up with ideas. So then it was really hard for me because nobody in Los Angeles, well, that's not true. Not nobody. A lot of people in Los Angeles didn't want to play original music. So I would go to auditions, and it was a top 40 circuit back then. So you had to be able to play Summer and Led Zeppelin. You had to be able to play 10cc and, you know, I don't know, the Parliament Funkadelic. And these musicians got fantastic because of that. Mark came up through that, playing four sets a night, being able to play everybody's music. That's why he's such a great player. But I would go to these auditions, and they would be like, well, you know, you're not exactly playing Old as Ice by Foreigner exactly like on the record. And I'd be like, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I kind of play the way I play. And by the way, I have a bunch of original music. We don't have original music. There's no money in it. And I was like, but that's what's the purpose of being a musician if you don't? I was young.
Yeah.
If you don't write your own music, if you don't write your own lyrics, if you don't. Whatever you're going through. And so I just eventually had to start putting bands together.
So this would have been, you got to LA when you were 17 and what, around 75? What was LA like at that time? This is post Laurel Canyon, sort of post the Troubadour Club type of stuff. Like, what was the scene like then?
It was great. It was really great because you had punk rock. And it was kind of faltering and new wave, which was, in retrospect, had some bands with some really good songs. But it, as a young kid that was like watching Don Kirshner's concert, Midnight Special, and seeing the New York Dolls and seeing Aerosmith on a stage this big and just doing Train Kept Rolling, I'm like, this is not for me. And again, it just reinforced what I wanted. But there was rock bands, and there was some kind of hippie rock bands, and there was punk rock, and there was new wave. And I just felt like none of it fit me. I wanted to push, and that's where eventually, you know, getting together with Blackie Lawless, we were like-minded, you know, we formed a band, which was Blackie's band, if you read the book, called Sister. And then it was all original music. I remember sitting there with Dane Ray on drums, John St. John on keyboards, Lizzie Gray on guitar, Blackie on guitar and vocals, and me on bass in a studio. And I it was the first time I was recording a studio, and I called my grandparents back in Idaho, and I said, I found the people, right? I found the people. And I knew that was the right path. Blackie is a leader. I'm like naturally like a band leader because I had to become. Otherwise, I would have been on the top 40 circuit, and I'd still be playing Cold as Ice in Orange County. And so, but Blackie fired me and Lizzie and Dane because we were green, we weren't very good in the studio, and that already been writing all these songs, but it's Blackie's band, it's Blackie's songs, which later went on to become Wasp, and he's a great songwriter and very talented musician. And we formed, again, it was like, well, we don't want to be the Plimsolls or the Go-Go's or the Knack, and we don't want to be Fear or Dead Kennedys. We want Cheap Trick meets Sabbath meets, you know, Mott the Hoople, Queen. And that's where the band London, that's how it formed. And then we got really big on the scene because there was nothing like it. And was I knew there- I was on the right path. You know what I mean? I wasn't playing other people's music, or I wasn't in someone else's band.
Because you were being true to your own voice. I mean, was that ever scary for you, though? Were there ever moments when you thought, okay, this might not work out? Or did that not even cross your mind at that point?
It didn't even cross my mind. I never even thought about it. I never considered quitting. I don't know if that's courage. You know, you say, oh, that young kid had courage, or if he was just had blind faith. But I wanted what I wanted. I lived in 24 hours a day. It's all I thought about. All the way back in Idaho, I would draw pictures of bands. I would draw the, you know, the amps and what the stage set would look like. And in the writing this book, we went all the way back and like met, you know, reconnected with old friends, wow, like my first girlfriend. And a couple of the people said, yeah, the thing with Nikki is we were in Jerome, Idaho, population 4,000. On Fridays, they would have in the auditorium, some musicians would come in from wherever. And I remember there was this like bass player with a huge afro and bell bottoms, and this guitar player that had this long shaggy hair and a weird mustache and a drink. And I was just like, that is what I'm talking about. The band last week, and everybody would always say, I would leave these things, whether it was in Los Angeles or in Idaho or in Seattle, and I made my notes of what they did wrong. What if they did this? They did this. If that band, that hook should have started, and they all laughed. They were like, oh my God, it was like torture, you know, notebooks full of what the perfect band. It's all I thought about. And it was the songs and the lyrics and the visual and anything short of that, I wasn't interested in.
It's so fascinating to me going through sort of the list of influences you've cited. I mean, you've got Queen and Sabbath, but also you've got like Harry Nilsson and Elton John and these people that really are amazing songwriters. I mean, the craft that goes into their pieces are so interesting. I mean, who are some people like that that are, you know, maybe not people that people would necessarily expect to be influences on you, but folks that really taught you what it is to make a good song and a good melody and really craft that?
It was about studying. It was about studying, constantly studying. I was bad in school, but great in front of that record player. I would sit there and I'd figure it out, like, listen to on the headphones and get ideas of my own, because everything that I was absorbing, I was like, oh, I could put that into this idea, or I could put it into that idea. And I hadn't become a really good songwriter yet. I was just learning, and it was really exciting. It's funny, Harry Nilsson, you bring up Harry. My son Decker's middle name is Nilsson. I was in Idaho, and we made money by doing all kinds of odd jobs. And I saved up enough money. I was at my friend's house to go down to the local like drug store that sold, you know, everything from milkshakes to vinyl. And I said, I'm going to go down there and I'm getting the new Deep Purple record. And everyone was like, yeah. My whatever it was, $5.98 from mowing lawns. I got on my bike, and my friend's sister was a couple years older. Now you got to remember, this is the 70s. She had on Daisy Dukes, a tube top, and this long all one length hair. And I would literally stare when I was to his house. I'd be like, You know, but she wanted nothing to do with a dweeb like me. You know, I was, I had no game. I had no nothing. I couldn't even really talk to her that. She was probably like, your friend is weird. And then all of a sudden she paid attention to me. She said, hey, Frankie, can I ride down to the vinyl shop with you? And I was like, yeah. And so she rode down and I went to the Section D, and there it was, Deep Purple. I'm like, I got it. I heard it on the radio. I'm going to absorb everything on this record. She goes, you know, you should buy this one. And I was like, no, I'm good with this one. She goes, batted her eyes and said, you should get this record. And it was Harry Nilsson Schmilsson, has Jump Into the Fire on it, Without You on it. And I went back and my friends were like, where's the Deep Purple record? And so then I fell in love with Harry's music. And as the years went, I found that he was a great influence. So if I was doing a riff like the ba-na-na-na-na on Too Fast for Love. Yeah, Too Fast for Love. The verse, I would like, well, what would Harry sing over this? Wow. What would John Lennon sing? What would Robin Zander sing over this? And then, well, how would Tony Iommi play this? So, you know, I was a train wreck as far as creativity. It was all this stuff. Pick a lane. But I just couldn't get enough. And it was funny because years, decades later, went to an AA meeting and we went around the room and one of the things they do is, you know, you say who you are and if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict. So I'd be like, I'm Nikki Six, and I'm all of them, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I'm a this, I'm a that, and I'm here to get better, right? Next guy says, you know, I'm John, I'm an alcoholic. Next guy goes, I'm Harry, SCAP BMI. And I'm looking at this older gentleman and I'm like, kind of looks like Harry. It can't be Harry Nilsson. Anyway, next guy. So it comes up to me after the meeting and says, Hey kid. I guess I was a kid. I was like 30. Right. And he was probably, I don't know, 55 or something. And says, can you give me a home? And I said, yeah, you know, well, depends. Where do you live? If you live in, like, you know, Beverly Hills, no, because it's like 2 hours away. I live in Hidden Hills. Like, oh, I live in Hidden Hills too. So on the drive over, we started talking. It was Harry Nilsson. We started talking about music. I went in. Me and Harry became good friends. Harry would show up at my house and there'd be a on the door out of nowhere, just a weird time of day. And Harry would be standing there and he goes, this is my friend, Richard. It would be Ringo Starr. And they would come in, they would sit in there. I don't smoke and I never really dug it when people smoked in my house, but they were both smoking and they were sitting in my front room telling stories about the Beatles and about, you know, this and this thing that John did with Harry at the Troubadour, or that you know, some of those famous stories we've read about. And I'd be like, smoke all you want, man, because I'm just absorbing this. And it, you know, he got to understand who I was and that I was a songwriter and Motley Crue. So we kind of talked about possibly me producing a record for him. And I was just like, wow. Thank God to that, you know, for that girl with the tube top. look how life is. And unfortunately, Harry did pass away, and I forgot to do that. But I named my son's middle name after him. But you know, that's how music is, man. You meet people, and they say be careful, you know, meeting your heroes. Everybody's had that happen. I'm sure you've interviewed people and got off and was like, wow, that guy wasn't what I thought he was, or that girl. But at the same time, you can cultivate all this positivity from people you meet, whether listening to records or reading their interviews, or if you're lucky enough to meet them or become friends. And, you know, guys like Steven Tyler had a big effect on me. That's my Rolling Stones. And Steven messages on my voicemail when I was struggling with addiction and he would sing into my mind. You know, I would just be like, this is like one of my, you know, childhood heroes. You know, the whole experience of discovering music is one of the most exciting things for me.
Thinking of everything you're telling me now, I mean, is there a separation between you, Nikki, and Frank Jr.? Do they almost feel like two separate people? Do they sort of coexist in you?
Well, that's a really great question. So I changed my name because of the information that was downloaded into my head when I was a kid by my mom about my dad. Mm. That's why I changed my name. It could be Frank Ferrano in Motley Crue or in London or in anything else I would have done. But it was about, I'm not going to carry on your name the way you did me. And that information was not all 100% true, we found out, and going back and going through this, talking to family members, talking to people that were there when my dad did leave, and why did he leave? So I think that there was a separation of my own family, my own legacy, which I've done. But in retrospect, I realized that Frank and Nikki are the same person. Now, Sicky, that's the other guy, he's a little different, but I don't think he exists. He might only come out every now and then. But in general, I've enjoyed getting to know myself as a child, not through the lens of Motley Crue or through the lens of anything else, just through the lens of family members telling the story. The things that I realize now are so important to me. When I hit the 70s, I had a foundation of family that I blamed it all on my dad, so I split. You know, and I did. I had a great grandmother, a great grandfather, a great family members that were around, but it was something in me, you know, made me walk away from that life.
I mean, it's something that I feel like I'm coming to grips with now, my own life. I'm in my early 30s. You grow up, you leave home, you start putting your head down and working hard and trying to build your own life with your own people and your own connections. And all of a sudden, you sort of realize that you want to reconnect with your past, that you want to, you know, sort of learn more about who, I don't want to say who you were, but sort of what's deeper inside of you. It's almost like the inverse of that John Lennon line, you know, life's what happens when you're busy making other plans. Suddenly you realize that there was this whole other history that you had. Was this cathartic for you, getting in touch with these family members and your first girlfriend? What was that experience like for you?
I mean, it was definitely cathartic in a lot of ways. It couldn't have happened in a better time, in a worse time, obviously, mm-hmm. during the pandemic. But I spent a lot of time talking to people, and I couldn't spend a lot of time face-to-face, did a lot of Zooms, a lot of interviews, a lot of things that I would hear that I forgot about, and you would hear from three or four different people, and you go, wow, I do the same thing now. You know, it's these habitual things, and a lot of them are positive, and there's obviously always negatives in there too, and you try to grow from that. I feel that when people read the book and this information from like 10 or 20 people that more like 20 or 25 people that I are very close to, and I've sent the book to, and they were like, I see my own childhood. I see, like, wow, when I was that age and I discovered this band, it really changed my life. And when it got me to think about what I wanted to do, people were like, you know, when I was going through my first 21, now I'm like a professional photographer and I shoot some of the biggest bands in the world. They didn't end up picking up an instrument. They ended up picking up a different instrument, a camera, et cetera, et cetera, journalists, et cetera. So I think inside the first 21, and my dream is that, yes, it's about a young kid, you know, coming from Idaho, a dream, But it's also about you and your story and the next person and the next girl. And I think that people can absorb it. I don't know if I would call it a wholesome read, but it's definitely has a different tone to it. I wanted to have empathy, and I wanted to, through discovery, give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You know, I was young. This is what was downloaded to me. You know, maybe it happened this way, or maybe it didn't happen that way. Like my dad leaving, my uncle said something made your dad really mad and he never came back. That moment to me, and again, I don't have documented proof, even though I am in touch with the family that raised my sister who was born with Down syndrome. My dad was a super proud Italian, Sicilian. He wanted his son named after him. And he wanted to take my sister home. But, you know, she was home with us for 11 months. Obviously, she couldn't walk because she was too young, but she could never walk. She could never talk. She was blind. She had a heart problem. She had Down syndrome. She needed a family to take care of her. In research, we believe the moment of impact why he left was when my sister went to at the home. And for me, it was my first taste of people are disposable. Like, she's gone. I could be next. It's very young, right? And then you get a mom that's saying, your dad's a bad guy. Your dad's an alcoholic. Your dad was a womanizer. Your dad was a drug addict. And then I talked to family members, and my uncle Bob said, well, you know, I don't think I ever saw Frank ever even drink a beer. And your mind's like, oh, what the fuck have I been carrying around with me for all these years? And then I had to go through forgiveness. I got to forgive my mom, forgive my because like, I got five kids. I got a career. I got an amazing wife. I don't want to sit around rehashing things that I don't even know for true. So let's go and let's get going.
I hope you feel lighter.
Yeah, I feel a lot lighter, except for COVID-19. I think everybody put on their at least COVID-10. I'm like, I feel lighter, but man, I miss being mobile and physical and going to the gym and running. And, you know, so part of this process during the writing of this book is, you know, we left Los Angeles and sold our house and moved to Jackson, Wyoming, and top of, and you can't see anybody from our house. So I went from complete suburbia and hearing stories from my friends about they're buying bulletproof backpacks for their kids. And I'm like, Jesus. You know what? I need to get back to my roots. And COVID helped us make that final decision. We've been thinking about it. And my wife loves it here. And I get to come back, but I also get to raise my daughter here and reconnecting. And I just feel so much healthier and better and, you know, looking forward to getting out on the road with Motley Crue. Grounded, more grounded. I'm very, I have ideas. I write down, I step one, step two, step three leads to blank. You know, I always say, we want to win the Super Bowl. How do we move back all the way to draft, right? You got to get the right players. You got to have a coach. You got to have the right defensive line. Bam, bam, bam. And I don't really, like the idea of like going to the Super Bowl and just being like, well, we went to the Super Bowl, but we lost. Very driven, you know, with my band, with Motley Crue, with everything else I do. But being grounded with COVID, being in Wyoming has got me to be a little more in my body, if that makes sense. Like less like everyone's like, if you got a problem, call Nikki. He'll like help. He'll work. You know, he's a team player. And now I just feel like cut loose of that brain always on fire, you know?
I meant to say earlier, I mean, you recently celebrated 20 years of sobriety. I mean, first of all, most importantly, congratulations. I mean, an incredible achievement. The last year, year and a half has been hard on all of us, but especially people struggling with substance abuse issues. I know many people in my own life that have had a really rough go of it in the last year and a half. What would you say to those people that really are feeling the isolation and the stress and the anxiety and the pressure of the COVID situation that are struggling with addiction?
It's definitely a hard time for people, all people, in different ways, financially and families, not being able to see each other. What I found for me that helped during this time was to go inside, because I can't go outside like I want to. So I go inside, doing some inside work. So being a person in recovery, there's a lot of tools out there. It's like, you know, maybe I need to redo my fourth step. Maybe I need to reach out more. Maybe I need to make a hot list of people that are also in recovery and reach out once a week, send them a text, say, how's it going? We have to become more of a community in that sense, because one of the great things about AA and NA and some of these programs, and not everybody adheres to those same principles, but is that you have a community of people that are like-minded and going through a recovery, right? They're just like what I was using. I only hung out with people that were using, right? So when you get into recovery, you go and you go to your meetings, you have a sponsor, and you go to a program. You start to build up some time and you're like, wow, this is the first time in my life I've gone a week without drinking or a month without drinking. And people get to a year. And so now they can go to their meetings. They can. Now there's a lot of Zoom meetings, which is fantastic. Some speaker meetings via Zoom. But I believe going inside, doing some inside work right now would be beneficial for when eventually we can really go back outside.
That's incredible advice. And I know we all can't wait until you can go back outside with Motley Crue. I know the stadium tour has been pushed back a year, wisely so, for
two years.
2 years. You're, oh my gosh.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
You know, acceptance is the answer. Right? So I was in full, you read the first chapter of the stadium tour in the book? So it's about, you know, the training and preparing and what we have to do. The reason that I wanted that book, instead of starting on the second chapter, which was all the way back, was I wanted people to know where I was at now before you flash back. And I also wanted fans to understand the hard work that it takes to be in a band. And you asked me, like, when I was younger, was I ever scared? Was I ever, you know, worried? Was it? I don't know. My wife says I will work till the day I die. I love work. I love solving problems. I love inventing things and watching them become real. You can touch it, listen to it, play it. So I wanted people to see that in the stadium tour, what diet was like, what training was like, what dedication was like to the musicianship. You know, it's a lot of work. And it was like right up there. It was like I was ready to go to rehearsals, to start pre-production and get on tour. I was, you know, in the best shape I've been in a long time. I could, my musicianship was on top of where it had been a lot of years, because, you know, I had a focus, a reason to focus, instead of like just playing all day like these two. You know, I got kids, I got a wife, I got other businesses. So now it was like pure focus was on the stadium tour and then COVID. But I wanted to know what that looks like. Like when it becomes time again, probably for me in about December, I will go back into that first chapter. And by the time I hit the pre-production, you know, and rehearsals in May, and then the show in June, I'll be, you know, up, but what I'll be up and ready to go. And so will the band. What I like is the idea of right now going inside, doing some work, finding out better ways to deal with different types of situations, and then going back out. My hope is that when people get back into it, they're not like, all right, thank God I'm back. You know, we can French kiss and blow boogers at each other and let's just spread the germs. It's like, what did you learn during this time? What did you learn about yourself? I learned a lot about my kids. I learned a lot about my family. You know, I was forced, and they were forced to be together. So when the news first came in Los Angeles, I pulled all my kids. They were out of college, out of everybody was living in the house. So like we had like the dinner table was packed every night. Anytime my kids come over for, you know, dad's birthday or Christmas or different holidays, spend a day here, come over 4th of July, spend the weekend, jump in the pool. They have their own lives, right? It does not revolve on me. I'm here and they always know I'm here. But now we were all together in the kitchen at 9 a.m. drinking coffee. And I'm like, you know, that's my favorite coffee cup you're drinking out up there. And, you know, have you thought about ever doing dishes? You know, there's all this stuff that you're like, wow, this is my family. These are my kids. This is how our personalities are. And, you know, we got into watching movie night. One night my daughter would cook, the next night my wife would cook, the next night my son would cook, and no one ever wanted me to cook. So cool, you know?
Well, that's all really wonderful. I mean, hesitate to use the phrase silver lining, but really, I mean, that how often would that happen that you've got, you know, all your kids there as a family, just, you know, not for a special occasion. It's just you're all back under one roof. That's really special.
Yeah, it was, we tried to make the best of a horrible situation. And I know it's different for all different, you know, types of people. And I know a lot of bands are out on the road and they're touring right now. And we chose to not do that. You know, we said we didn't have enough proof to believe that we would go on the road and our fans would be safe or the crew or band members, or we'd end up in cancellations or what, because we're playing stadiums. We have to also, you know, mitigate the weather, right? So we start in June. It's great outside. Get into like mid-September, and depending on where you are, this first is an American tour. You know, so we don't really have time to cancel 5 shows and add them in late October or December, because they're all outside. If it was an arena tour. So, you know, everyone's doing the best they can. A lot of my friends call me and they say, this is what the road's like. This is what's happening. I don't like to name names because then it becomes some version of bait. You know, 4 media outlets from you is like, Nikki Sixx said he talks to blank and they said this. I'm like, and they tell me, you know, what they're going through. Some of them say it's like touring during the apocalypse. Of them are like, you know, we're so insulated living in a bubble and we're trying to stay safe as possible. I have people that are placed smaller places that say they don't go on the edge of the stage because the fans are right up against the barricade and they're right there. And they're, you know, like, this is what you live for, to be on stage right in the fan's face. They're in your face. They're like, this is like such a cool moment. And they're like, yeah, I have to stand back from the audience because I don't want to get anything. Also, we know now that we can be carrying it, not even know it. So, you know, the testing, and some bands have doctors on the road. So I think we made the decision by just doing it next year. There'll be better guidelines, so to speak. You know, I didn't want to be a guy in a band or any of the members of my group say, if you want to come see us, you have to do this, because I'm not their dad. My band's not their mom. We wanted it to be mandated by like with Live Nation. So Live Nation announced that you can't get into the shows unless you have proof of vaccination or a negative test. That's great. At least those people that are going to that show understand what their situation is, and they're not mad at name the band.
Right.
So I think by next year, we're going to have, you know, a lot more clarity on what's going on. I'm dying to get on stage. I mean, I'm dying to get back in the gym. I'm dying. My book, man, I worked my ass on this thing. And I can't believe like I'm holding it. Like it's unbelievable. My wife like had it last night. She goes, can you believe it? Like happens so fast. Well, because of coronavirus, I wasn't touring. I wasn't going to the office. I wasn't doing photo shoots. I was just working this thing. And, you know, for me, a huge loss was I lost all my book tour.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, and we talked about it, like, what do we, like, have a class all and, you know, I can see the fans, they can see me, but how do I get the book and sign it? And then a lot of the, retail was like, well, you know, we're not comfortable. My book's really exciting. 1,000 or more people per city. And, you know, how do we do that? Do we let 10 in at a time? This book is going to take 12 hours. You know, we don't feel safe for our employees, like all this stuff. So the book tour is gone and it bums me out. But, you know, again, like the tour, we're just trying to do the best thing that we can do for the big picture.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait until the band can get back out there, and I can't wait till people are able to read this. My last question for you, if you could go back and talk to that 17-year-old kid getting off the bus in L.A., what would you tell him?
I would tell him just follow his heart. We all like have guidance, and if you can tune into it, I didn't have a backup plan. My kids, when I'm like, okay, well, you're going to go to college and you're gonna take a business course. So whatever you do, you're going to be able to manage it and have at least an idea of success. I had no backup plan. I had to read books. I had to figure out how lawyers work. I had to figure out how not to get ripped off. I had to start my own record company with Motley Crue because no one wanted to sign us. And I'm glad we did because we have one of the most lucrative record deals in history because we were now the band everybody had to have. We took our records, our masters from Elektra Records and own our music completely, everything about it, brand. And I didn't know that when I was in Idaho, sitting in the park, like playing this fake Les Paul, but you had to learn it. So like follow your guidance, follow your gut, but do the work, do it. If it's inside or outside, do the work. You want to be a guitar player, do the work. You want to be in broadcasting, do the work. I believe in hard work. That's the guidance, hard work, determination. I will work anybody if I can, I will stay in the studio longer. I will rewrite a book if I have to, if I don't think it's good enough. I constantly believe in improvements and improvements. And it's worked for me. So I guess the only thing I would say is like, just keep educating yourself, man, out there. Keep educating yourself. And someday I'll write that book on how to, when you make it, not end up broke 5 years later.
We definitely need that book out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, man. Fantastic interview.
Oh, Nicky, thank you so much for your music and your time today. It's a huge honor. Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.